Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Part 1 of Tea and the Effects of Tea Drinking. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Tea and the Effects of Tea Drinking by William Scott Tebb. Section 1. In March 1904, the Southwark Borough Council, at the request of Sir William Collins, gave permission for an inquiry to be made into the constituents of tea in order to ascertain what injurious ingredients were present, and if it were possible, to obtain the characteristic effects without subjecting tea drinkers to any of the deleterious symptoms. The subject will be seen to be of importance, and I propose to include a brief history of the use of the tea plant, together with a general review of the experience gained by those best competent to judge of the effects since its introduction of what has now come to be considered a necessity of life. In addition, there are set forth the results of examination of different samples of tea and the general conclusions to which I have arrived. What we call tea is called by the Chinese cha, tha, or te, and by the Russians, chai. The original English word was tea. At least this is a name used by Samuel Pepys, one of the earliest to allude to the herb in this country. Tea was afterwards altered to te, as will be seen from the Pope's lines in the Rape of the Lock. Soft yielding minds to water glide away, and sip with nymphs their elemental te. Or again, hear thou, great Anna, whom three realms obey, dost sometimes counsel take, and sometimes tay. Some of the modern editions of Pope have altered the spelling at the expense of the rhyme. The tea plant, Thea sinensis, botanically speaking a close ally of the camellia, is in its natural state a tree which attains to 20 or 30 feet in height. Under cultivation, it remains a shrub from 3 to 6 feet high. It grows in all tropical and subtropical countries, and roughly it takes the labor of one man a day to produce a pound of tea. The leaves, the only part of the plant used in commerce, vary from 2 to 6 inches long, are evergreen, lanceolate, and serrated throughout nearly the whole margin. The leaves are stalked and arranged alternately on axis. The flowers somewhat resemble apple blossoms, but are smaller. The shrubs are planted in rows of 3 or 4 feet apart and look like a field of currant or gooseberry bushes. At the end of the third year, the bushes become large enough to allow of the first picking, and in the eighth year, the plant is cut down when new shoots spring up from the old roots. In Ceylon and parts of India, the first picking is in March, and there may be as many as 25 pickings in the season until October. In China, the first picking is in April, and in Japan, late in April or early May. The early pickings make the finest quality of tea, and the very late leaves are not usually exported at all, but are used by the peasants locally. In preparation for commerce, the leaves are subjected to various processes of drying, rolling, and roasting, into which it would not be necessary at any length to enter. The essential point to remember is that black tea differs from green in that, after a short preliminary rolling and roasting, the leaves are exposed to the air in a soft, moist state when they undergo fermentation, with the result, it is said, that a portion of the tannic acid is converted to sugar. Robert Fortune, an authority on the cultivation of the tea plant, thought that the difference of manufacture fully account for the difference in color as well as for the effect produced on some constitutions by green tea, such as nervous irritability, sleeplessness, etc. When we come to look into the early origins of the practice of tea drinking, we find that the subject is shredded in the mists of antiquity. There are many legendary stories of the discovery and use of the tea by the Chinese, but the only authentic and well-attested accounts were given by two Mohammedans who traveled in India and China in the 9th century. The original manuscript was found in the Camp des Signales library by Eusebius Renaudot and published in 1733. There is plain internal evidence that the manuscript was written about 1173, for there are observations upon the extent and circumference of the walls and towers of Damascus and other cities in subjection to the Sultan Nuruddin, who is spoken of as living at that time. This prince died in 1173, which fixes the date of the narrative before that time. The account speaks of the Arab merchants having been present in China in the years 851 and 867, respectively. On page 25 occurs the following important passage. The emperor also reserves to himself the revenues which arise from the salt mines and from a certain herb which they drink with hot water, and of which great quantities are sold in all the cities, to the amount of great sums. They call it sa, and it is a shrub more bushy than the pomegranate tree, and of a more taking smell, but it has a kind of bitterness with it. Their way is to boil water, which they pour upon this leaf, and this drink cures all sorts of diseases. Whatever sums are lodged in the treasury arise from the poll tax and the duties upon salt and upon this leaf. Tea was therefore much in vogue in the 9th century. From China, the knowledge was carried to Japan, and there the cultivation was established at the beginning of the 13th century. From that time until the 19th century, China and Japan have been the only two tea-producing countries. As with all innovations, Europe, and particularly England, was very slow to take to the practice, for tea is hardly mentioned by any of the writers prior to the 16th century. One of the earliest to allude to the subject was Giovanni Botero in 1596, in his treatise on the causes of the magnificence and greatness of cities. He remarks that they, the Chinese, have also an herb out of which they press a delicate juice, which serves them for drink instead of wine. It also preserves their health and frees them from all those ills that the immoderate use of wine doth breed unto us. It will be observed that in these early accounts, much stress is laid on the beneficial action of tea in preserving health and curing disease, and this was in all dated 1686, gives a long list of qualities and operations attributed by the Chinese to the pains in the head, vanquish superfluous sleep and heavy dreams, open obstructions, clear the sight, strengthen the memory, sharpen the wits, and quicken the understanding. About the year of 1657, Thomas Garway of the Exchange Alley issued a sheet proclaiming the virtues of tea, the alleged qualities being almost identical with those given in the Sloane manuscript just mentioned. This was a sort of advertisement of his place of business, and he tells us that many noblemen, physicians, merchants, and gentlemen of quality sent to town for the said leaf and daily resort to his house in Exchange Alley to drink tea. He informs us that prior to 1657, it was only used as a regalia in high treatments and entertainments, and for presents for princes and grandees. Another early reference is from the advertisement in the Mercurius Politicus for 1658. and by all physicians approved China drink, called by the Chinese cha, by other nations tei, alias tea, is sold at the Sultanate Head, a coffee house, in Sweetings, Rents, by the Royal Exchange, London. A further early reference is by Thomas Rugg, which may be seen in a manuscript at the British Museum. About this time, the Parliament that was forced out in the 13th day of October, 59, it was called by all sorts of persons the Rump, because they were so few in number, and there were also at this time a Turkish drink to be sold almost in every street called coffee, and another kind of drink called tea, and also a drink called chocolate, which was a very hearty drink. It is rather difficult to reconcile this account of the prevalence of the use of tea as a drink with that of other writers of the period. Thus, Pepys, writing a year afterwards under date September 25, 1660, says, "I did send for a cup of tea, a China drink, of which I never had drank before." This clearly points to the novelty of the practice in 1660, for Samuel Pepys was Secretary of the Admiralty and a public man of keen observation, and it is almost impossible, if tea was commonly sold as a drink at this time, that he should have been unaware of the fact. Macaulay also mentions that about this time tea had been handed around to be stared at. It seemed therefore clear that the herb was quite recently introduced in 1660, and it is possible that Rugg, under the name of tea, is referring to hot infusions of other leaves, for it is well known that herbs were commonly used for making different sorts of teas, as sage tea, etc. The first official notice of tea is in the Act of Parliament, 12 Corollis II, circa 23, by which a duty of 8 pence was charged on every gallon of coffee, chocolate, sherbet, and tea made for sale. In 1662, Charles II married Princess Catherine of Portugal, and the poet Waller has immortalized tea drinking by a birthday ode in her honor. "The muse's friend, tea, does our fancy aid, repress those vapors which the head invade, and keeps that palace of the soul serene, fit on her birthday to salute the queen." 2 years later, the king was a recipient of the then valuable gift of 2 pounds 2 ounces of tea from the East India Company. End of Part 1. Read by Ellen Corcoran. Part 2 of Tea and the Effects of Tea Drinking by William Scott Tebb. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Part 2. In Pepys' diary under the date of June 28, 1667, we read, "Home and there find my wife making of tea, a drink which Mr. Pelling, the paticary, tells her is good for her cold and deflections." Tea, therefore, was just coming into vogue. In 1669, the East India Company received 2 canisters containing 143.5 pounds. The price at this time was 60 shillings a pound. The company imported 4,713 pounds in 1678, but this amount probably glutted the market, for in the 6 subsequent years, the imports were quite inconsiderable. In 1697 to 1699, the imports averaged 20,000. In 1700 to 1708, they reached 80,000 pounds. In 1728, over 1 million pounds. In 1754, 4.5 million. In 1763, 6 million. And in 1779, nearly 10 million pounds. It is not necessary to follow the imports during the whole of the 18th century. Speaking generally, it was found that excessive duties led to smaller imports, and at the same time to a large increase of smuggling and other irregularities. Since 1800, there has been an enormous increase of consumption in the United Kingdom, as will be seen from the following figures. Table A. Years 1801 to 1810. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 23,717,882. Average annual population, 16,794,000. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 1.41. Years 1811 to 1820. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 24,753,808. Average annual population, 19,316,700. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 1.28. Years 1821 to 1830. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 28,612,702. Average annual population, 22,433,900. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 1.27. Years 1831 to 1840. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 34,441,766. Average annual population, 25,257,200. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 1.36. Years 1841 to 1850. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 44,286,600. Average annual population, 27,566,300. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 1.61. Years 1851 to 1860. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 65,160,456. Average annual population, 28,172,400. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 2.31. Years 1861 to 1870. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 97,775,548. Average annual population, 30,027,600. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 3.26. Years 1871 to 1880. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 144,462,622. Average annual population, 33,055,020. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 4.37. Years 1881 to 1890. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 178,130,836. Average annual population, 36,178,144. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 4.92. Years 1891 to 1900. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 224,076,800. Average annual population, 39,440,316. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 5.7. Years 1901 to 1903. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per annum, 255,270,472. Average annual population, 41,550,773. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 6.1. Since the beginning of the last century, therefore, the average consumption per head has increased from 1.4 to 6.1 pounds. In our Australian and New Zealand colonies, the quantity consumed is even much larger than in the United Kingdom, as will be seen from the following table. Table B. New South Wales. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 8.01. Victoria. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 7.38. South Australia, except North Territory. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 8.87. South Australia, North Territory. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 6.44. Western Australia. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 10.07. Queensland. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 7.09. Tasmania. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 6.62. All Australia. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 7.81. New Zealand. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 6.78. The enormous quantity of tea consumed in Great Britain and our colonies will be better appreciated if comparisons are made with other countries. Table C. Russia. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 0.93. Germany. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 0.12. Holland. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 1.48. France. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 0.06. United States. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 1.09. Canada. Average number of pounds of tea consumed per head per annum, 4.64. I should like to say a few words concerning the sources of tea supply to the United Kingdom. Of course, until fairly recent times, practically all the tea came from China. Early in the last century, it was found that the tea plant was indigenous to India. In 1825, the Society of Arts offered their gold medal to the person who shall grow and prepare the greatest quantity of China tea of good quality, not being less than 20 pounds weight, in the East Indies and British colonies. In 1832, Dr. Wallach made a report on the cultivation of tea in India and said that under a well-directed management, the tea plant may at no distant period be made an object of extensive cultivation in the Honorable East India Company dominions. Several years afterwards, in 1839, the Society of Arts Medal was awarded to Mr. C. A. Bruce for discovering the indigenous tea tracts and successfully cultivating and preparing tea in the British possessions in India. In 1840, the first Indian Tea Company was formed. In 1853, tea was growing in Cachar. In 1856, in Sylhet, and in 1864, in Darjeeling and other places. Much more recently, Ceylon has become prominent in supplying this country with tea. It came about in this way. The coffee plantations were destroyed by disease in 1868, and the planters succeeded in growing cinchona and tea as alternative crops. This experimental growth of tea in Ceylon has now become a flourishing industry. The following table shows in 5-year periods since 1866 the proportion of each 100 pounds of tea imported into the United Kingdom from India, Ceylon, China, and other countries respectively. Table D. Years 1866 to 1870. India, 6.62, Ceylon, 0, China, 91.44, other countries, 1.94. Years 1871 to 1875, India, 10.5, Ceylon, 0.08, China, 85.62, other countries, 3.8. Years 1876 to 1880, India, 18.26, Ceylon, 0.06, China, 80.18, other countries, 1.5. Years 1881 to 1885, India, 26.73, Ceylon, 0.86, China, 70.71, other countries, 1.71. Years 1886 to 1890, India, 39.66, Ceylon, 10.96, China, 47.07, other countries, 2.32. Years 1891 to 1895, India, 47.1, Ceylon, 29.3, China, 21.04, other countries, 2.56. Years 1896 to 1900, India, 50.25, Ceylon, 36.3, China, 10.52, other countries, 2.93. Years 1901 to 1903, India, 58.45, Ceylon, 33.28, China, 4.74, other countries, 3.53. It appears that China, which formerly supplied 90% in 1866, now contributes less than 5% of our tea. During the same period, the Indian supply has gone up from 6 to 58%, and Ceylon, which only commenced to send tea in 1875, now sends a substantial proportion of 33% of the total importation. From the above tables, it will be seen that the nearly average of 6 pounds consumed in the United Kingdom, 1/3 of a pound comes from China, 3.5 pounds from India, and 2 pounds from Ceylon. The Dutch, the next largest tea drinkers to the British, consume 1.5 pounds each person per annum. Half of this comes from Java, and the remaining half from the United Kingdom, principally of Chinese origin. Most of the tea drunk in Russia comes from China. In Australia, 2/3 of the tea is imported from India and Ceylon, and the rest comes from China. In the United States, more than half the tea comes from China, and the bulk of the remainder from Japan. End of Part 2. Read by Ellen Corcoran. Part 3 of Tea and the Effects of Tea Drinking by William Scott Tebb. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Part 3. I now proceed to deal briefly with the constituents of tea, which are generally believed to impart to the tea infusion its special characteristics. Alkaloid. The alkaloid which is present in tea to the extent of 3 or 4% is thought to be identical with that found in coffee, viz., caffeine. It has the well-known stimulant and invigorating qualities with which the taking of tea is associated. Thus the brain is stimulated, the intellect becomes clear, there is removal of languor and fatigue with increased wakefulness and alertness. The following is by a Chinese writer who lived over 1,000 years ago, and he writes so well and so much to the point that we must not quarrel with him if he has omitted to give us the reverse aspect of the question. It tempers the spirits and harmonizes the mind, dispels lassitude and relieves fatigue, awakens thought and prevents drowsiness, lightens or refreshes the body, and clears the perceptive faculties. We shall also forgive Cooper's strong prepossession in favor of tea when we call to mind the cozy, comfortable picture which he describes. And while the bubbling and loud hissing urn throws up a steamy column, and the cups that share but not inebriate wait on each, so let us welcome peaceful evening in. I suppose that this verse has been as much quoted as anything in our language, and the homely picture of the evening meal has done much to wean the English people from stronger drinks. The following article from Lancet of 1863 presents all arguments, and very important arguments they are, and very well stated, which can be placed to the credit of tea drinking. It has a strange influence over mood, a strange power of changing the look of things, and changing it for the better, so that we can believe and hope and do under the influence of tea what we should otherwise give up in discouragement and despair, feelings under the influence of which tissues wear rapidly. In the language of the poor, who in London, we are told, spend 1/8 of their income in buying tea, it produces a feeling of comfort. Neither the philosopher nor the philanthropist will despise this property of tea, this power of conferring comfort, or removing ennui, of promoting those happier feelings of our nature under which we can do most and bear most. There is no denying the considerable dependence of our moods and frames upon substances. And as moods are as important as muscles, as they affect as largely a man's ability for the great ends of life, we cannot regard the cheapening of such substances, when devoid of noxious qualities, as other than a most important benefit to the poor. This feeling of comfort, this power of changing the aspect of affairs, of appealing to the happier side of our nature, in other words, of putting us at our best, is undoubtedly due to the alkaloid of tea. Since I have been interested in the subject, I have conversed with a number of friends, and many have told me that the best time of the day to do any writing or intellectual work is after a cup of tea in the afternoon, and I must confess to feeling more myself at this time than any other. But, on the other hand, if no afternoon tea is taken, this period of the day is when most people feel fagged and tired and incapable of mental exertion. This shows the great influence exercised by tea over our moods and feelings. And if tea is taken in moderation, this property may be of great help and a mental stimulus to us in our daily vocation. Tannin. The other important constituent of tea, viz., tannin, is present to the extent of 10% or 20%. And is the substance to which most of the injurious effects of tea have been attributed. In excess, tannin tends to depress the action of the digestive fluids and ferments. It interferes with the normal activity of secretion by constricting the blood vessels and diminishing the circulation. And lastly, it tends to combine with the nitrogenous principles of the food, rendering them insoluble and incapable of digestion. The tendency, therefore, of this substance is greatly to impair digestion, and it gives rise to palpitation of the heart, headache, flatulence, loss of appetite, constipation, and other symptoms so well known at our outpatient departments of our general hospitals. On inquiry, it is often found that the patient is accustomed to drink large quantities of tea, which has stood for long periods and consequently extracted excessive amounts of tannin. In addition to the alkaloid and tannin, the older writers asserted that the tea contained a volatile oil to the extent of 0.6 to 1%, and many of the qualities and deleterious effects of tea have been traced to the presence of this substance. The latest experiments, however, throw some doubts on these early results. Thus, in the report of Schimmel and Company, for April 1897, it is stated, page 39, that in former years we endeavored on several occasions to distill various kinds of tea in order to introduce tea oil. We have, however, in no case succeeded in obtaining more than mere traces of oil, and they conclude that in the hands of the early experimenters, the oil found on distillation was due to the artificial flavoring of tea, which was common at the time. Schimmel and Company, in their report for April 1898, page 50, refer to a report of the Botanical Gardens in Buitenzorg for 1896. It appears that experiments were made on a large scale, Thus, 2,500 kilograms of freshly fermented tea leaves were submitted to steam distillation, and 130 cubic centimeters, or 0.0052%, of oil was obtained. It must be remembered that this oil was only found in the freshly fermented leaves. From the minute quantity, I think we may conclude that tea oil, if present, has little or no connection with the qualities and attributes of tea, or the deleterious effects to which it may give rise. A word or two with a reference to the adulteration of tea. In former times, a good many samples, and especially of green tea, were faced. This consisted in the addition of some coloring matter as Prussian blue, turmeric, or indigo, and sometimes black tea was faced with graphite. Another practice formerly prevalent was the addition of various leaves having a resemblance to tea leaves. And then there was the use of the exhausted or spent leaves. All of these forms of adulteration are now happily very seldom practiced. To shew the extreme rarity of tea adulteration in this country, in the 17 years from 1887 to 1903, 7,595 samples were purchased under the Food and Drug Acts, and of these, only 23 were found to be adulterated. These fixtures include 15 cases in 1898, and according to the report of the local government board for this year, many were of the description known as caper tea. This is one of the China varieties and consists of small granular masses made up by the aid of gum and starch, and this lends itself to the addition of sand and stones, as actually happened in the case in question. I think that with this exception of mineral matter, tea adulteration in this country may now be said to be practically non-existent. We have glanced through the general effects of the important constituents of tea. I now propose to consider the amount of harm which can be justly attributed to this popular article of daily consumption. The opposition to tea on the ground of injury to health is almost as old as the introduction of tea itself. One of the earliest objectors was Dr. Simon Pauli, the physician to the King of Denmark. In a commentary he wrote on the abuse of tobacco and tea, he objected on the ground that tea is moderately heating, bitter, drying, and astringent. He felt it incumbent on him to warn Europeans against the abuse of tea, especially as the herb, he said, by no means answered the encomiums bestowed upon it by the Chinese and Japanese. I wish all persons, especially such as are old, would obstinately reject tea, which so dries the bodies of the Chinese that they can hardly spit. Pauli was also a strong opponent of coffee and alleged that it produced sterility. Another powerful writer on the subject was Dr. Cohausen, a learned and ingenious German physician. The works of this author were numerous and bore evidence of the vigor of his intellect and of his application to letters. His work entitled Neothia and published in 1716 was written to shew the folly of sending to China for tea when we had so many herbs to hand, just as pleasant and far more healthy. His wit, for which he was justly celebrated, was not sufficiently powerful to render the use of tea unfashionable. Boerhaave, the great Dutch physician and follower of Hippocrates and Sydenham, had an objection to tea, but not so much to the herb itself as to the practice of drinking of hot liquids. He refers to those persons who weaken their bodies with perpetual drinking of aqueous liquors. Such is the very bad custom which prevails among the Dutch, who indulge themselves in a sedentary life and all day long use those Asiatic drinks made of the berries of coffee or leaves of tea. He also attributed to these drinks certain nervous disorders. I have seen a great many so enervated by drinking too freely of those liquors, tea, coffee, and the like, that they could hardly move their limbs. And likewise, several who were seized with the apoplexy and palsy from that cause. An early lay opponent of tea drinking was John Wesley. He tells us that when he first went to Oxford with an exceedingly good constitution, he was somewhat surprised at the certain symptoms of a paralytic disorder. His hands shook especially after breakfast, and he observed that if he gave up tea drinking for 2 or 3 days, the shaking ceased. On inquiry, he found that tea had the same effect on others, and particularly on persons whose nerves were weak. This led him to lessen the quantity and to drink weaker tea, but still for about 26 years, he was more or less subject to the same disorder. In 1746, he became to observe that a number of people in London were similarly affected, some suffering from the nerves with the decay of bodily strength, and he asked them if they were hard drinkers, and learnt in reply that they drank nothing but a little tea, morning and evening. He came to the conclusion that they suffered from the effects of tea like he had himself. Wesley thought he should set an example and broke himself of a practice which had lasted for 27 years. The first 3 days he suffered from headache more or less all day long and was half asleep from morning to night. On the third day his memory failed, but the symptoms abated in the following day and his memory returned. He felt great benefit from the abstinence and found that his hand was steady at 45 as it had been at 15. One of the most determined opponents of tea drinking in the 18th century was Jonas Hanway, the eminent philanthropist and father of Sunday schools. His views may be gathered from the title of his work. Owing to the results of this beverage, he said, "Men seem to have lost their stature and comeliness, and women their beauty. What Shakespeare ascribes to the concealment of love is, in this age, more frequently occasioned by the use of tea. I am persuaded the inhabitants of this island will never increase in number nor enjoy blooming health whilst they continue such an extravagant use of tea." Hanway's exaggeration succeeded in drawing Dr. Johnson to the controversy. The great man, in a review of Hanway's work, said, "He is to expect little justice from the author of this extract, a hardened and shameless tea drinker who has for 20 years diluted his meals with only the infusion of this fascinating plant, whose kettle has scarcely time to cool, who with tea amuses the evening, with tea solaces the midnights, and with tea welcomes the morning." We learn from Boswell that no person ever enjoyed with more relish the infusion of that fragrant leaf than Johnson. The quantities which he drank of it at all hours were so great that his nerves must have been uncommonly strong, not to have been extremely relaxed by such an intemperate use of it. Boswell says that Johnson assured him he never felt the least inconvenience from it. In a footnote on page 105 of Boswell's Life, we are informed that a Mr. Parker of Henley was in possession of a teapot which belonged to Dr. Johnson and held above 2 quarts. At the end of the 18th century, Dr. Lettsom, a well-known authority on the subject, published a work on the natural history of the tea tree. He found that amongst the less hardy and robust complaints were ascribed to the drinking of tea. There are many who cannot bear to drink a single dish of tea without being immediately sick and disordered at the stomach, and that in irritable constitutions it speedily excited the nerves to such a degree as to give rise to uneasy sensations and bring on spasmodic affections. He also says, "I know people of both sexes who are constantly seized with great uneasiness, anxiety, and oppression as often as they take a single cup of tea." For children, he thought it decidedly harmful. Children and very young persons in general should as much as possible be deterred from the use of this infusion. It weakens their stomach, impairs the digestive powers, and favors the generation of many diseases. On the whole, however, he was not altogether opposed to the practice in strong, healthy, vigorous adults. To such it is undoubtedly wholesome, and equal at least, if not preferable, to any other kind of regale now in use. On another page we read that, "If not drunk too hot, nor in too great quantities, It is perhaps preferable to any other vegetable infusion we know. Quite at the end of the 18th century, Dr. Buchanan, who was something of a medical reformer and had naturally observed the results of tea drinking, thought that the ill effects proceeded rather from the imprudent use of it than from any bad qualities in the tea itself. In his Domestic Medicine, page 74, he says, "Good tea, taken in moderate quantity, not too strong, not too hot, nor drank upon an empty stomach, will seldom do harm. But if it is bad, which is often the case, or substituted in the room of solid food, it must have many ill effects." He observed that females who live much on tea and other watery diet generally become weak and unable to digest solid food. Hence proceed hysterics and all their dreadful consequences. In the early part of the 19th century, we have the opinion of William Cobbett, a vigorous writer and acute observer of the habits of the time in which he lived. In his Advice to Young Men, Cobbett remarks, "Let me beseech you to resolve to free yourselves from the slavery of the tea and coffee and other slop kettle, if unhappily you have been bred up in such slavery. Experience has taught me that those slops are injurious to health. Until I left them off, having taken to them at the age of 26, even my habits of sobriety, moderate eating, early rising, even these were not, until I left off the slops, sufficient to give me that complete health which I have since had." The most complete but painful description I have come across of the distressing symptoms occasionally associated with tea drinking is given by Dr. James Henry, who writes in 1830. He refers to the case of a gentleman who commenced the use of tea of ordinary strength at the age of 14. Shortly afterwards, sleep became less sound, and he became nervous and easily agitated about matters of small consequence. Afterwards, he suffered from an uneasiness, even while sleeping, also from nightmare and palpitation of the heart. His sleep was disturbed during the whole period of 10 years. During this time, he took 3 cups of tea in the morning and 3 cups in the evening. At the age of 24 or 25, he used tea more freely, and his sleep became more and more disturbed. He sometimes took tea twice in the same evening. The suffering was very great. He did not fall asleep at night until 2 o'clock, and the agitation of mind and body was indescribable. The pulsations of the heart were sometimes quick and faint, and sometimes so violent that he could not lie on his left side. Sometimes the pulsations became scarcely perceptible for several moments. At such times the patient felt as if he were dying, and if he fell asleep, he awoke with a violent start. He wished to sleep that he might avoid the distressing sensations which he felt while awake, but feared to do so lest his awakening should be accompanied by frightful agony. After a time, the distressing sensations were so marked, especially just before going to bed, that, in the society of my family, I felt myself so agitated without any apparent cause that I was unable either to speak or think deliberately, or even to remain in one position, and have been obliged, that I might not be thought insane, to rise abruptly, hurry out of the house, and take violent exercise in the open air. At 30 years of age, he renounced tea and never suffered afterwards. The very first night I slept soundly, and I have never had any return either of sleeplessness or of starting or of the sensation of imminent death, unless on the rare occasions when I have returned to the use of tea. Dr. Henry argued from the above that tea and coffee act as a poison upon some persons, and on turning his attention to the subject, he found that such cases were far from uncommon, and concluded that, like alcohol, tea may be indulged in for a series of years without apparent ill consequences, but that sooner or later it undermines the health and renders life miserable. As with alcohol, he recognizes 2 stages. The first stage was characterized by agreeable sensations in the stomach, moderate perspiration, quickened pulse, and increased vivacity of mind and body. In the second stage, there was irregular pulse, sometimes rapid, sometimes slow, and intermitting, with palpitation and pains in the region of the heart, a vivacity of thought and action which is quite uncontrollable by the will, a painful insensibility to impressions of all kinds, twitchings of the muscles, disturbed sleep, frightful startings, especially in the evening, irregular and sometimes cold perspiration, impaired appetite, and defective circulation in the extremities. He concluded that the immoderate use of tea and coffee produce a disease which bears a close resemblance to the delirium tremens of whiskey drinkers and which is almost identical with the disease state induced by the excessive indulgence of opium. End of Part 3, read by Ellen Corcoran.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. You won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.